Okay. Unfortunately, you will have the benefit, I'm not sure if you can call it a benefit, or the unfortunate circumstance of having me before you today, because I've just gone through like 2 months of teacher training, and so I may employ some practices that you're not used to this morning. So I hope it will be okay. It won't be anything too crazy, but it may be a little bit uncomfortable for a few moments. But I hope it will be productive. That is the point. We'll be focusing on verses 7 through 25 of Romans chapter 7. So you go ahead and turn there. Now the context of what we'll be talking about today is going to be a little bit more general in the study of what the verses have to say there. But preceding those more general statements, we had a specific illustration. That's what we've been talking about with the law of marriage. And he is using this illustration to make a point about the law. And so the verses that we'll be looking at today really concern the relationship between the law and sin and the relationship between us as mankind. Between the law and sin. And so I'll break it up into sections and we'll discuss those few sections. I don't know what's popping. I don't have a mic. Maybe something is going on. Nevertheless, verse 7. We'll go ahead and start in verse 7. I'm going to read down through verse 11. Okay, we'll read 7 through 11 right now. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, "You shall not covet." And I'll read that one more time because these first few verses sound a bit problematic with our preconceived ideas about the law and sin. So he says, I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. And it seems a bit contradictory. So I want you to be thinking about how you can justify these ideas with these verses. Because in verse 7 he says, is the law sin? Certainly not. But he says, I would not have known sin had it not been for the law. So how would you justify that idea? Be thinking about that as we continue through verse 11. Verse 8, but sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, and he's going to explain himself as well, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me. And by it, it killed me. Now, he's already established that the law is not sinful. And that the law, there's nothing wrong with the law. So, then how can we answer his explanation of saying it was because of the law that he knew sin? How would we justify that? And here's where my teacher stuff, and I'm not going to employ everything, I promise. But I want you to talk to the person next to you, around you, to answer this question. Don't talk to me, don't talk to us yet. Take about 3 minutes. How can you justify that idea? By him saying it was the law that made him know sin. Go ahead. And I'm really good at wait time. I don't get uncomfortable with silences, so. Again, the question is, if the law is not sin, then how does he know sin because of the law? A couple more minutes. One more minute. Keep talking. If the law is not sin, how did he then know sin because of the law? All right, go ahead and share. What were your ideas?
Until somebody tells you that it's wrong, you don't know. You could be doing something, you don't know it's wrong until somebody tells you it's wrong.
Okay.
So they didn't know it was sin until the law came out and said, this is wrong, this they've been doing, they might have been doing this all their lives and not knowing it was wrong until the law.
You know, when you're not accountable, when you're young, you don't know what sin is. You don't know what things are sin, but you're not accountable. When you become, you receive the knowledge by reading the law, what is right, what's wrong, and then when you sin, then when you do those things, then you sin. And of course, you die spiritually if you don't do whatever is necessary to take care of us.
Yeah, and I think that last statement that you said is central to the verses that we'll talk about today. So, I mean, clear, and you're right. You know, if I didn't know it was wrong, then it wouldn't be a big deal. But now that I have a law, I know that something is wrong. And, you know, he's talked about before, well, then it would be better not to have the law. So, I think we need to take it one step further. If it would be better not to know the law and to not know of sin, then we don't know of death, and wouldn't life be easier? So then, why would, and I know this is a simple question, but I think it's necessary to establish as we progress through the verses, why then would God have created a law? So that we don't die in sin? You're right, that's all right, and that's right. But, and maybe I'm asking a bit too ambiguous of a question. Does sin exist with or without the law?
Without law, there is no sin.
And he'll talk about that too. And the point that I think that the author is going to get to in just a moment, and we'll talk about this, is that there is a natural default setting within man that existed in Genesis, and this is something to consider, that, and stay with me on this, that with or without law, there was separation from God. With or without the knowledge of the law, there is still separation from God. Whether or not I know the law or not doesn't mean that I'm still not enacting in some type of sin. That I was dead or alive is not necessarily contingent upon my knowledge of the law. And it was at that moment when I learned the law that I realized that I was dead. And that knowledge is a large burden. And it's easier to go throughout life without law, without understanding law. But I think it can be said of all of us as humans that at a certain point we realize that there has to be some standard of behavior. Whether I know God or religion at all, there is something about us as humans that says there's some standard or some code of something that enables me to behave in a certain way. I talked about this whenever I was teaching Animal Farm. The idea of Animal Farm is they create their own society. They start from the bottom and create their own society like the Russians tried to do. And so I asked my students, we were doing a rhetoric lesson, and we paired Ronald Reagan's Evil Empire speech with this. You know, and he says in that speech, you know, America will never forget about God. America will always be a nation under God. And he's saying this as the president, not before he was president. He's saying this as the president. And so I made them give a speech on whether or not he was justified in doing that. Can he say that as president? Does that take away freedoms? You know, all that wonderful things. And it boiled down to saying either yes or no. And if you say yes, then you say God is the standard. And if you say no, then you say God is not the standard of behavior. Well, then you have to answer what is. Right? Even if you say, even anarchists, whatever, who is the master? Himself. There's still a master. And so that has to be answered no matter what. And he's going to get existential and broad in his dealings here. And I think we have to do the same. And those more philosophical ideas, or philosophical type of ideas, not philosophical. So, verse 11, for sin taking occasion by the commandment deceived me, and it killed me. And we know the nature of the devil, and we know the nature of sin. And I think verse 11, well, let's pair verse 10 and 11 because he's contrasting life and death here. And the commandment which was to bring life, I found to bring death. And we've established what that means. And then verse 11, for sin taking occasion by the commandment deceived me, and by it killed me. How does sin deceive, and how does sin kill?
Talking about spiritual? Well, that's sin killed you spiritually.
Okay.
So if you commit sin and kills you spiritually, if you continue in sin, or if you...
Is he only talking about that in verse 11? And you'll find that I'm opening up to... I'm not going to pigeonhole you into an answer. It may be yes, it is. I just want you to justify it.
Deal with Adam. When Adam sinned, of course, we didn't have physical death. So Adam sinned, and then after Adam sinned, and then we died physically.
Okay. Yes? We haven't talked about how it deceives. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, all through Romans, we're having two different groups that are being addressed here. One who came through up without knowledge of the law of God, and one that did. There's a Jewish one who didn't want to do it. And so, I think especially when you're talking about in verse 7, when you use coveting as an example, that in the Gentile world, there were things that were obviously wrong. It's wrong to murder somebody. Steal, cheat, but coveting—that's a sin of the heart, and that's not covered under, except unless you know the law of God. And so, this coveting—and now that I'm coveting wrong, am I tempted to do it? I think is what he's saying here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the law of God is something I think is the pervading thought here. One of the pervading thoughts, and it's easy to look at law and the law of God and get them confused. And they're not the same. One's man's law and one is the law of God. And I was going to bring this up, and I like that you already did. I think it's worth noting who the author is from a human standpoint. It's Paul. And where is Paul coming from? What life experience is Paul coming from that might affect what he's saying here?
He was a Jewish scholar.
And what moment in Paul's life would have rang true to what he's saying here? Once I learned the law that once brought me life, or that I thought would bring me life, actually brought me death.
Well, when he realized he's killing Christians, that's wrong. He's not doing right. He's not doing God's will.
And, you know, think about Paul. He's so educated. And he's so zealous of a man that you know he's got all his ducks in a row. And he learns that he's doing the exact opposite of what is right. And so I think Paul really understands the weight of the law, the weight that the law should have on every one of us. And he understands that it completely changed him. And it killed him, if you want to get a bit more metaphoric. It killed him. It killed the old man. And if law doesn't kill the old man, then you're not honestly looking at the law. And I think it's a heavy moment that is found within these verses. And we, all humans want law, want order, want something that makes sense of everything around them. And whenever you find that, it should be a relief. Here is the purpose. Here is the construct with which I make my decisions, with which everyone else should make their decisions. And I think that's what he's saying in verse 10. The commandment which was to bring life, the law which was to give me life through God, to give me spiritual life, I found because of my state. And in fact, it brought death because of the weight of it. It should kill us inside. The old man that is subservient to sin. And I think it's part of human nature, as Jerry was saying. You know, don't covet. Now I'm going to have to work on that. And I think that's ultimately, and maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, ultimately what he's saying here. Once I know the law, that means I'm going to have to work. And if I don't, death is upon us. Yes, sir?
I think one of the things we forget about, Gentiles had law also. Hammurabi had a law long before Paul. You know, we think too often that it's just God's law, but there are some Gentiles that have a law. The difference is
right, and we're not talking to, complete lawless individuals as far as social constructs are concerned. I mean, law has existed in some form since society has. Now, it hasn't existed in every society, but clearly it's existed in society. But so that's kind of what I was talking about, maybe didn't do it sufficiently enough, is that if you're willing, if any individual is willing to honestly approach any social law, without the principles of God behind it, you will still be wanting. There will still be something missing. For God's law is transcendent. And it's the principles that God's law has, every law should fit inside of it, or else we as man will know that something's amiss. But what often happens is we're okay with that. And when I mean we collectively as human beings, not as Christians. But we're okay with that and we stop there. And we can talk more about that, but that's a really good point to put in perspective. People that would have been hearing the gospel, it's not as if they don't know what law is. They just don't know what God's law is and the weight of what God's law is. And that's what Paul's trying to reveal here. Let's continue on to verse 12. And clearly he will make it a bit more clear. Therefore, there's that great word. I said all this to say this. Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. Has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not, but sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. Gotta love those adverbs. Exceedingly sinful. Read this verse 12 and 13 one more time. Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just and good. Has then what is good become death to me? Which is what we kind of just established. Well, the law brings about death because of the knowledge of death. And then he says, no, certainly not. So it seems like it's a bit contradictory. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. Talk to the person next to you. What do verse 12 and 13? What does verse 12 and 13 mean? 3 minutes, go. Feel free to go to commentaries that you have on your Bible or anything like that. I'm cool with my students having their phones out if they do that. Which opens it up to bad possibilities. That's okay. 1 minute. if you go ahead to a couple of verses, that's fine. They might explain it. Okay, what do verses 12 and 13 mean? The whole point of the beginning of this. Yes, sir.
Could you summarize what he said, but I didn't hear a word of it?
Sure. Independent of the knowledge of the law is what we've established already, and I think he put it really well. Man is still lost. And God can have no participation with darkness or with sin. Therefore, when I sin, and the law says that you cannot sin, the law is perfect and I am not. Therefore, it separates me. I mean, these are fundamental principles of Christ and of following God. And in the latter part of verse 13, I think that, you know, we have that conjunction there. So, you know, as a result, sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. So whether I know it's sin or not, it still separates me from God, as it is wrong. But because of the law and my knowledge of the law, if I then sin in spite of my knowledge, it is a more willful sin. It's exceedingly sinful. Now, does that matter, bottom line? Can something be more exceedingly sinful than another?
Well,
then why would he say something is more sinful?
It's a perception of it. The law makes us perceive it how it really is, which is really, really bad.
It's not only our perception, but it's also the influence it has on us. If you sin and you don't know it's wrong, and you find out it's wrong, I will say it again louder. If you sin and you find out that it's wrong, and that makes you feel horrible and you want to correct it and fix it, then that's a reaction you can't have if you knew the law before you sinned, and then you went against it, and by that you scarred your heart, and that affects you more deeply.
Right. And you're right. You're right. Sin is sin. Yes. Go ahead.
But you also look at the fact that warning for teachers and preachers, you know it's right. If you do not follow it right, you're punished. Is it more punishment? Is it a little hotter now? No.
No. It's the heart. It's all about the heart. You're right. And it's not about consequences or degrees of torment. You're right. It's exceedingly sinful. My heart has been more scarred because of that. Because I knew the law and I did it anyways. Or I knew there was a law and when I sinned, it didn't affect me. Now, oh, it's you know, as if I didn't know the law. It's about our heart. Our reaction to that sin. Verse 14, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For what I am doing, I do not understand. And well, before we get into verses 15, because it sounds really, really confusing, and it's not. And I think if we keep verse 14 in mind, it will help. Not that we won't get it, but it will help it be more clear. This is the principle whenever you are discussing any issue, whenever you're looking at anything concerning our lives and how we conduct ourselves, is verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual, and I am carnal. Sometimes we try to make the law fit our carnal wants, and that's when we get into trouble. And that's where, you know, false doctrine comes into play. Law is spiritual. God's law is spiritual. And if we ever try to make God's law fit any type of carnal situations, then that is when we start violating the basis of what it is. And then that's when it gets confusing. And you know what? We can do that even on the side of truth. We can follow law because for carnal reasons, even if it is what the law says. And I think it's something that is worthy of consideration. You know, we're following what the law says, but is it because of the spiritual nature of it, or is it because I want to make sure I don't hurt my family's feelings? Or things of that nature. Or this will help if I proclaim this truth in this manner, even though it may be truth, this will give me more respect amongst my brethren, or whatever it may be. And it's a principle that needs to be partnered with the law every time we meditate upon it, every time we speak about it, every time we practice it. That the end game, that the purpose, is for spiritual reasons. And if we find ourselves looking for a carnal reward, then we're missing the mark. And it's worthy of consideration. Verse 15, for what I am doing, and it's going to get a little bit, it's going to sound odd because, you know, the word will can be a noun or a verb, and he's going to use it both. Or, in fact, the translators will use it in both ways. So we'll read verse 15, and I'll stop whenever, I don't remember where it is. I'll find it when I get there. Verse 15. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice, but what I hate, that I do. Sounds like a riddle. I'll do it one more time. And it's really not as complicated as it seems when you keep those perspectives in mind. When I will to sin, when I sin because of my weaknesses, I'm willing to sin. Okay? And keep in mind, you know, the ideas of knowing the law, not knowing the law, and that idea of does it matter and all those things, it plays into part here. Verse 15, one more time. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If, then, I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. I think that's a good part to stop at right there. I'm going to read that section one more time. I'm going to give you a couple minutes to answer what does it mean. And then we'll have to answer, well, what do we do about that? All right, one more time. Verse 15 through 17. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. What do those verses mean? Take a few minutes to digest it and then talk to the people around you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a phrase-by-phrase analysis. Think about big principles that we've already established. Just about one more minute. Class ended 15 after? 20 after? Okay, what does it mean? Verses 15 through 17, what does it mean?
I think he's having, generally, I think he's having to talk about the mind and the flesh.
Yes.
And what in the mind he does, what he knows to do, but the flesh. He said, but the flesh thing tempts him to do things that he should not do. Basically. Now.
Sure. Yeah, and that's basically it. Yes, sir.
But my answer was not going to be too far from his answer. More or less, in general, the person is seeking to be righteous. The person seeking to be like God is going to always want to do right, but we are still fleshly beings. We are still fleshly beings. Still will at some point succumb to the temptation to sin. And it's not the thing that we in general want to do, but in a moment of weakness we do it. And when we do that, we prove two things: that God is good and that the law is just and right.
Yeah. There are contradictory wills going on at the same time. And I think that's why, and if just from a nerd perspective, it's perfect how it's worded. Because that's exactly what's going on internally.
Deal with it every day.
Absolutely. Yes.
And that goes to answer his, what seems illogical statement. So it is no longer I who do it, but the sin, okay? The me that wants to be righteous is not what it is. It's the me that would be.
Good. Anything else before I give my little smile? Oh, yes, sir.
What does it matter? No matter what it on these, if we have a choice who dwells in us, I'm going to keep that in mind. The explanation of all this.
Right. And that's my next point. It's not as complicated as it seems. It's really that simple. And I think Josh did a good job of saying that. You know, I will to serve God. But I also, if we're honest with ourselves, will to serve myself. And there are often times when what serving God means is does not coincide with the will to serve self. And so I'm faced with a dilemma at that moment. And it's what we really have to understand about ourselves as human beings. And there really is a default setting to us. And I'm not saying that we're some programmable robots. But does it take any effort whatsoever as we live our daily life to serve ourselves? We all have natural appetites, instincts, whatever it is, from the moment we are born, feed me, pick me up, hold me, give me a toy, so on and so forth. We understand that. But as we become adults, that manifests itself into adult behaviors, sin is created. Being a Christian is saying that my will is subservient, is secondary to God's. Yet, I still will have those ideas. And as Christians, it is up to us to practice that so that those ideas become less and less. And exactly what Dick was saying, I told my kids, I keep going back to the... There's a movie called Tomorrowland. I don't know if you've seen it with, what's his face? George Clooney talking about some futuristic society. Here's all these dystopian type of ideas. Anyways, the dad's talking to his daughter in the story about this kind of lesson that he always told them. There are two wolves within every person. And there's this wolf of discouragement and despair, and there's a wolf of hope. And they're both equally strong. And the question is, which wolf wins? The one you feed the most. And that's what you're saying. You know, those two wills are there. Which will is going to win? Which will within ourselves is going to be the stronger will? Well, it's the one with which you practice. In spite of those natural inclinations. In spite of those natural carnal inclinations. And it's right, we're still flesh. And there's the war between the flesh and the spirit. And the war has to be won. Verse 17. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. Sorry, we read that too. And that's what we're talking about. If I let sin reign within my body, it will become my master. Do you want God to be your master or sin? Those are two choices. For I know that in me, verse 18, for I know that in me that it is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good, I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. Now, Paul wrote it twice. By inspiration, it was written twice. And I know from going to school that if I'm reading something and it's repeated, I might better pay attention to it. But it's not an accident. It's not a word written down by someone for a reading that is by accident. So what is he emphasizing here? For the good that I will to do, I do not do. I've never been there. We've all been there. I want to do right, I know what the law says, and I will to do right, but I fall, and I do not do what is right. Even though way back there, deep inside, I know what I should do. I will to do it. I wake up, I don't think any of us wake up and say, how can I sin today in a more fun way? Or a new way? None of us get up saying that. But a lot of us still do not do what is good. But the evil I will not to do, I get up saying, today's going to be a good day for the Lord. I practice what I will not to do, the evil that I will not to do. He said that twice. And when that happens, what's dwelling within us? It's sin. But then that's how powerful it is. And we tend to think of that and only, you know, those, it's addictive. We tend to think of sin and only substance abuse. It could be any sin. Anger, lying, whatever it may be. It's habitual. Even though we will not to do it, it is that powerful. I think it's a sober reminder to us as Christians, to anyone who walks the earth. And I think it's something that whenever we're talking about spiritual matters, it could be very beneficial. That, you know, they're really... I think the majority of the people that walk the earth, this describes, the majority of the people will to do what is good. And the majority of the people wake up and say, I want this to be a good day and I want to help someone out. But it's so easy for us to let sin dwell within us. At the moment we say that, sin is a part of who we are. Unfortunately. And we have to work to not let that happen. Which will is going to be stronger? And he's warned us twice about how powerful that can be. Verse 20. Now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who did it, but sin that dwells in me. Verse 21. And here will be the last portion of our class this morning. Verse 21. I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, Who will deliver me from this body of death? We'll stop right there before we get to the conclusion. Okay. I see another law in my members. What benefit can we as Christians gain from verses 22 and 23? Verses 21 through 23. Let me change that. What benefit can we as Christians gain from verse 21 alone? I find then a law that evil is present within me, the one who wills to do good. Doesn't sound like a very beneficial verse.
Tell us what we need to correct. Find out a law that something we're doing wrong, and we need to correct that. So it's a benefit to us.
Okay. Gives you the situation so that you can game plan. Absolutely.
I mean, there are people who are raised without knowing God's will today, and they find out things that thought were okay or wrong, and they become Christians. That change.
And who's writing this? Paul. I mean, I'm not big enough a man to, if I was in the same room as Paul, say, man, you're pretty sinful. I mean, after he was converted, you read about the things that he did for the Lord. I would not describe him as a wretched man. And just for argument's sake, if we were to take, you know, that aspect of his life away, would he still consider himself a wretched man? Is he only referring to his life before he decided to serve God?
These whole paragraphs you're talking about right then. But we don't see him do a lot of bad things throughout the Bible, right? We maybe get a little more insight from Peter doing that and some other people doing that. But he does some of it. I mean, he starts yelling at a high priest. He knows he could well ought not to. He didn't know the God was a high priest, but probably shouldn't just go off yelling at anybody like that.
Even without specific instances, could you say that? That it was so? And why?
I can say that based on the previous paragraph. He said he's doing a bunch of things that are sinful. So
he says it.
So that's as far as you have to go. And he's talking about this battle within himself. He's not speaking, you know, hypothetically about himself there. There are a lot of words in the Greek that you translated a lot of different words in the English, and then the reverse, where we might have to translate them into more English words. But like he says law there in verse 21, you know. Is he talking about God's law? No. Is he talking about man's law? No. Is he talking about the laws of nature? No. He's just talking about truth.
A universal truth.
Here's this obvious thing I can see. I want to do something good. I really want to. And then I do something bad. There must be something bad within me, or this wouldn't be an issue. And then you're back to G.I. Joe. You know, knowing it's half the battle. You've got to go and do the other half.
Well, you're bringing the 80s back right there. Yeah. And I think as Christians, we often gloss over that aspect of who we are. You know, we work so hard not to be sinful that we start saying, oh, I'm not a sinful person. And if we ever lose this sobriety, then we lose sight of the law and it doesn't have as much weight as it should, which is where we started the class. The law should be something that is heavy. Now, I'm not saying that it should belabor us. You know, Paul says, lay aside every weight. We should lay aside our sin so that we may run the race. And I think we can all say that Paul does that. But he does that because he is observant of what the race is. I don't just go out there and play a football game if I don't know who I'm playing against because I've worked so hard up to this point. Yeah, I watched game film for, you know, the last 15 games of NFL here, so I'm not going to watch game film on the Super Bowl because I've done well so far. Because all of a sudden I've worked so hard that sin is not my master. Well, the second that I don't watch that game film, it is again. It's that natural default that we have as human beings. It's a law, a universal truth, that we all have that natural inclination to serve self in spite of the will to serve God. And there's not a moment that we can pass up. And ultimately it comes down to this. He says in verse 24, O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me with this body of death. And so, what is the answer to all this? 25, I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. The only way to ultimately win this battle is by grace. There's no way that we could do it by ourselves. Yes, ma'am.
In Matthew 26:41, Jesus is praying in the garden. He talks to the disciples saying, "Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak."
Perfect. And it's, we could have just read that verse and been done. And so, like I mentioned, it seems like some complicated verse section of passages whenever you read it initially. "For I will to do that which I will," and all those things. And it's not. It's not at all. It's more sobering than I think academically challenging, even though it may be phrased in a little bit way, but a difficult way. But this is the heart of who we are as Christians, our everyday. And we really need to be this type, and I hope you understand what I'm saying, this type of everyday Christian with a consistency. And that's what I mean by everyday. I don't mean like there's a degree of normalcy or anything like that, but consistency. And brethren, you want to win people to Christ? That's how you do it. That's how you do it, is by being consistent and honest with who we are as humans and who we are as Christians. And that's what Paul did, and that's why it's in the Bible. And he nails it. And I think Paul is probably the premier example of accessibility. You know, if you're trying to talk to someone about Christ and really put the Christian life in perspective, the one who works so hard to be all things to all men is probably the place to go. And you can look at his example of who he was, like we did, and see the words that he said, and all the things that he did for Christ. He still realizes this principle. And it keeps him grateful to God for his grace through Jesus Christ. And it's a powerful and sobering passage.
Apparently, doing something good could be bad. For example, if a preacher is preaching to please the people rather than please God,
it's carnal.
Then it's carnal. That's right.
That's right.
You see.
That's right.
Because he's looking for the praise of man instead of praise from God.
Yeah, it's easy to do that because of that war, and I think sometimes we do good to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. And that's the point. Like, I know if I don't do this, I'm going to feel guilty for about 3 days, so I better not do that. And that's our motivation. And it can't be that carnal motivation. All right, thank you.